Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Today's guests are two of the most instinctive cooks I know, makers of terrific food, not fancy, just real world stuff that makes you go, wow, that was great on any old Tuesday night, if you know what I mean. They're all about the joys of using whatever you have on hand. Tamar Adler, author of The Everlasting Meal Cookbook, is all about the pleasures of making or ordering a little more today to have all the makings of a new meal tomorrow. She can help you learn to open your fridge and make something terrific out of basically whatever is in there. And Hetty Louie McKinnon, vegetable whisperer and author of her new magnum opus, the cookbook Tender Heart, got her start from what her dad left lying around the house. And, well, I'll let her tell you about it while we take your cooking questions together. So, hey, Hetty, it's great to see you.
Hey, Francis. Always a joy to see you.
Hey, congratulations on the book. It is big. It's not its only quality, but it is big, but it is beautiful. And page after page, I'm like, I want to make that. I actually literally cooked out of it last night for dinner.
Oh, wow. But
tell us about the title, Tender Heart. Because at first I thought you were talking about like lettuce, but you're not talking about lettuce.
I kind of am. So it's a double meaning. So tender heart, I want it, because, you know, often we describe vegetables as, you know, they're ready when they're tender. Sure. And then that was kind of what started me thinking of that word. But then Tenderheart actually refers to my dad, who is the backstory of the book. I mean, I shouldn't refer to him. He is no black backstory. He's a front story. but the story is very much firmly based in my vegetable origin story, which is starts with a father who worked at the produce markets in Sydney. And I just grew up around vegetables, and it wasn't something that I thought was extraordinary at the time. It was just my life, stepping over crates of vegetables and fruits to get to the laundry and to get to the bathroom. That was just a very normal thing in our house. But my father actually passed away when I was a teenager, and so I've lived most of my life without him. And when I thought about writing a book about vegetables, my vegetable origin story was very much entrenched in the influence that my father's job had on our life, on my early life as a family, in the way we ate, in the meals that were prepared at home, in really our whole outlook towards food was really formed by the abundance of fresh produce in our house. I laugh because it's I'm remembering right now as I'm talking to you, and it really just, it was abundant. So so that's what Tender Heart is. It's my dad, but it's also a reference to how we should all feel about vegetables. And it's an all-encompassing term, really.
yeah. But tell us about that upbringing in that home. I mean, we've talked in the past about, you know, your inspiration. You know, your cooking is often inspired by Chinese dishes, Chinese cuisine that you grew up with, but, you know, with your own original take on it. But in your home, was it like a situation where, well, you know, dad works at the produce market, and so he comes home with cabbage and cauliflower, and so that's what's available. It's here, you know, it's inexpensive because we have tons of it. Or is it, well, we really loved vegetables and we really wanted to sort of highlight vegetables in our meals?
It was very much a part of, my dad just brought home a lot of stuff. And my mum, actually, when I was writing the book, I was talking to my mum about like the amount of vegetables. My dad was a very generous person. And that's another reason why Tenderheart was such a great description of him. And so he loved abundance. So he loved bringing home lots. And I spoke to my mum about this recently, and she said, frankly, she felt overwhelmed by the amount of greens that he would bring home. So she would pickle, you know, gai choy, like mustard stems. Like, she would have to pickle things because he just brought home so much. But that was, you know, and it wasn't just for fresh produce. Like, on Fridays, he'd brought home like mud crabs, crabs that were still, you know, trussed in pink string. They were alive, and I would kind of play with them before they were killed. You know, so it was.
Hopefully they had fun in the last moments.
Well, I'm vegetarian now, so, you know, lasting effects and all. But yeah, there was just an abundance of fresh food in our house. So that was very normal. And my mum, I lived in a very traditional Cantonese household. So my mum cooked a Cantonese banquet every night. We didn't really eat other foods. So, you know, and this is, you know, we're talking about, you know, how a Cantonese banquet goes, you know, 6 or 7 dishes with rice. I mean, when you look at that in the context of how we eat now, we struggle to come up with one meal, right? One dish.
Yeah, for sure.
Much less, you know, 6 or 7. But we definitely ate a lot of, you know, fresh vegetables. It was a very much part of our day. My mother never said, eat your vegetables. That's for sure. You know, it was just part of our diet. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, that abundance is so clear in this book as well. There's almost 200 recipes. And like I said, page after page, I was like, oh, I want to try that. I want to try that. So talk to me about some of these dishes. I mean, one that this isn't really a home food as much as I often see it as sort of like a Cantonese restaurant food. But you have a spin on shrimp toast or prawn toast, and you make it with like a mushroom puree.
Yeah.
Tell us about your sesame mushroom toast.
So like a very classic Cantonese dish is shrimp toast, or we call them prawn toast in Australia. And my mum didn't really make it at home though. My mum's two younger brothers have a Cantonese restaurant in Sydney. Mm-hmm. Still there. It's called Lee's Fortuna Court. It's quite well known in Sydney actually. And whenever we went there, a little treat was they would make prawn toast. And so it's basically white bread with like a prawn or shrimp paste, and then it's deep fried. It's got some sesame seeds on there, and it's just so delicious, served with like a tomato-y sweet and sour sauce. So my take on it is I do have a mushroom chapter, in the mushroom chapter there's a mushroom paste / pate. So you could just eat the pate with crackers, but I've smeared it onto some white bread and fried it. Got some sesame seeds on there, got a sweet and sour sauce. So that's my version of a shrimp toast. And so it really kind of encapsulates how I cook in a way, because I am vegetarian and have been so for over 30 years. I spend a lot of my time trying to recreate some of the foods I ate as a child, but a lot of those foods were not vegetarian. So that does serve as a huge source of inspiration to me.
Yeah, for sure. Tell me a little bit more about the mushroom pate. How do you make it? What's in it?
So you can really use any types of mushrooms. Mm-hmm. You can use wild mushrooms would be great, but you can really just use, you know, your regular button or cremini mushrooms. And you just cook those down and then you just kind of puree it. You can really like customize it to how you like it. I like it with a bit of texture, but you can puree it till it's, you know, quite blended if you prefer that texture. I mean, a lot of vegetarian food that I like is textural, so it's always kind of adding a mouthfeel that I find pleasing. But that I think that comes from being, you know, an almost lifetime vegetarian.
Yeah, I mean it's such a cliche to say mushrooms are meaty and a meat replacement, but like they have such great flavor, and texturally they're actually so interesting because like, oh, I think most people don't think of them as being something you can puree into like something smooth and beautiful.
And I thought everybody understood this, but I've heard people say to me recently when they cook mushrooms, it gets, you know, liquidy, and so they pour that liquid out of the pan before continuing the cooking, and that liquid is actually gold, you know, the when you cook, mushrooms are like a lot of water. They're very liquidy. They hold a lot of water. When you cook them, you should always keep cooking them until the liquid kind of cooks back into the mushroom, because that's adding the flavor. You're basically cooking the mushroom flavor out and letting it then evaporate kind of into and around the mushroom. And that's the way I like to think of it. I'm thinking about it in a really romantic way, I think. Yeah. But never pour that moisture away. You want that moisture to cook back in.
Totally. And I think something that helped me think about this too was when someone explained to me, you can't actually overcook mushrooms.
Yeah.
Like, so I think people are afraid, oh my God, it's been in the pan too long. They won't overcook. They're not going to turn to mush. They're not going to get hard. I mean, you can burn them, but that's a different issue.
Yeah.
But if they're cooking and there's too much liquid coming out of them, all you got to do is just let them keep cooking until that moisture evaporates and is reabsorbed and all that stuff. And, and like you said, that flavor reconcentrates and it's so good. hey, you know what? There are so many recipes in your book that I want to talk to you about, but we also have a lot of listeners who called in with questions for you.
Oh,
so maybe
cool.
Let's go to one of those for a second.
Awesome.
Hi, this is Lisa from Minnesota, and my question is about eggplant. I grow a lot in my garden, and I cook it Chinese-style stir fries, and I make eggplant lasagna. But what's another way to use eggplant that's easy, fresh, and quick? Or is there a better way to store it so I can use it during the winter? Thanks.
How interesting.
Oh, cool question, Lisa.
Yeah.
I mean, I have three words. Eggplant. Char siu.
Oh, tell me more.
So this is a recipe from Tenderheart. It's one of my favorites. It's basically a char siu sauce that you would use
The roast pork.
Like the Cantonese pork. Red roast pork. And you kind of smear it onto the just eggplant. Like just if you're using a regular globe eggplant, you just slice it. And you just bake it with the sauce, put some more on when it comes out, have it with rice. It's silky and it's sticky and it's delicious. So that's a really easy recipe. And, you know, thing to remember about eggplant is it's like a sponge. You know, it will soak up so much flavor. It also has a lot of liquid. So once you kind of roast it or char grill it, the liquid will come out and then it becomes like really silky. And because it is a sponge, the more sauce you put on there, it kind of like licks it all up and absorbs it all up. That's why like that great dish miso eggplant is so successful, because it's a really punchy, you know, very savory sauce, and the eggplant is sucking all of that up. So the eggplant char siu is a similar idea to that.
Okay. Wait, so tell us what's in your char siu sauce.
So my char siu sauce for the eggplant is basically my own concoction. I actually don't know how an actual roast pork char siu is made.
But it has been vegetarian for a long time.
Yeah, I've been a vegetarian a long time. But you've got hoisin sauce, you've got garlic.
So sweet and sort of pasty.
Sweet, pasty, sticky, some soy sauce, maple syrup for that sweetness, some rice vinegar, and 5-spice powder for a bit of a kick. So, yeah, it's a good one.
And smear it on the eggplant and bake it.
Exactly. And you can actually reuse that sauce for any number of vegetables, tofu. I think it goes really well with tofu too.
We're talking to Hedy Louie McKinnon, author of Tenderheart, a cookbook about vegetables and unbreakable family bonds. She'll be back to answer more of your cooking questions, so stick around. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave, but sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking to Hetty Louie McKinnon, author of Tenderheart, a cookbook about vegetables and unbreakable family bonds. Let's get back to your questions with her. So people have this thing about eggplant, and I have to admit, sometimes I come across it too. Every once in a while you get an eggplant and it just is extremely bitter. And I remember there are all these things that you're supposed to do. You're supposed to cut it and salt it and squeeze it and salt it again. You know, it's like a 9-step process.
Yeah.
You know, and I just like, okay, good night. I'm going to.
Yeah.
So normally I often buy the Asian eggplants. They're sometimes Chinese or Japanese. They're almost never bitter. And they're very long, but they have a very different texture.
Yeah.
Than the globe eggplants, which are sort of silkier, smushier. What do you do about that bitterness?
Well, I think that's when a strong sauce comes in. I'm like you. I'm a bit of a lazy cook, so I never ever salt my eggplant. The globe eggplants, the seedier they are, they tend to be the more bitter. But I think that as long as you cook it enough. Often I think eggplant is undercooked. People undercook eggplant because they see it kind of breaking down a little bit and they start to panic about how soft it's getting. But I believe that's when eggplant is at its best, when it's just on the cusp of being overcooked. And like steaming eggplant is, you know, a revelation. I don't think I've ever had a steamed eggplant that's bitter.
Oh,
you know, like a really traditional Cantonese like steamed eggplant, amazing, like black bean sauce, another punchy sauce that goes very well with eggplant.
Yeah, yeah. So you're just literally steaming the eggplant and then you're putting the black bean sauce on top.
Yeah, absolutely. And all the water kind of drains out as you've steamed it, so it's fantastic. Great dish.
Yeah, I have to say, like the black bean sauce that comes in just like. In an Asian market, but often like just in, you know, a generic supermarket, if there's like an Asian aisle, there's almost always that jar of black bean sauce from Lee Kum Kee.
Yep.
It tastes pretty good. Like, I'm never mad at it.
You're not going to be mad about it. It's pretty good. Yeah. I mean, honestly, though, if you can get a bag of fermented black beans, they last forever. I mean, it's really hard to get through a pack because they're so tasty. They're so salty. But to make your own black bean sauce is life-changing and really so easy.
How do you do it?
I basically take some black beans, give it a little rinse, then mash them up.
And these are the Chinese fermented black beans, not black beans that you would boil and serve.
Yes, exactly. They're
it
not.
It is confusing because I would be like, black beans. Okay, sure.
Yeah, well, they're black soybeans, fermented black soybeans, to be more exact.
There you go.
So you take those fermented black soybeans, you give them a bit of a rinse because they do tend to have the salty, the crystallized salt on the outside. Then you just mash that up because once you've rinsed it, it becomes quite soft. You mash it up with some garlic. I grate some garlic, fresh garlic in. Some red chili or red pepper flakes, and then just some oil, and you've got a homemade black bean sauce that is pretty fantastic.
And then you steam your eggplant, and you put some of that on top.
Yeah.
And there you go. Bingo.
Bingo.
That sounds great. All right, cool. Let's get to another caller. This person didn't leave their name, but as we're heading into summer, this sounds like it's a pretty good question. I don't even know how to call for it. It's the one without a name.
Hi, Hetty and Francis. I have a question about cooking while camping. Do you have any good veggie recipes to cook over the campfire or on the small camping stoves? Planning to do some camping this summer. I would love any recommendations you have. Thanks.
I love this question. I haven't gone camping in a while, I'll be honest, but I love it. And one thing that it is often lacking is fresh vegetables because they're heavy or they're delicate. You don't want to cram them in your bag. So people end up cramming junk food or dehydrated food or whatever. What's your thought for what to do at a campsite?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm actually a non-camper. I don't think I've ever camped
like
in my...
Blind meeting the blind here.
Exactly. I don't think I've ever camped in my entire life. However, I do have an answer for this. Like, a whole roasted cauliflower, there is nothing wrong with that. Almost zero preparation. And I will often, even at home, roast a cauliflower because I'm too lazy to chop it up into florets or wedges or whatever. It is literally the easiest way to prepare cauliflower. And one of the most delicious because you get crispy on the outside and the inside is just tender enough. I mean, I like my vegetables quite like al dente, like not overdone. But I think on a campfire, that would be amazing. I don't have a barbecue anymore, but when I used to have an outdoor area, I had a smoker, and this is going to be a similar result to a campfire. I would smoke whole cauliflowers and just unbelievable. The smoke that permeates, it goes all the way through the whole cauliflower. And, you know, you don't have to really do anything. I would just smear it in oil and spices, you know, whatever spices I had on hand. The other thing I wanted to add to this for this question is Asian greens. See, I think Asian greens, well, they're underused as a category of vegetable. But in Tenderheart, I have this amazing charred gai lan, which is Chinese broccoli, otherwise known as Chinese broccoli. A gai lan is just, when I had a barbecue, I would grill this all the time. It's the perfect green to be grilled because the stem is robust enough that it's not going to fall apart. And the smokiness goes really well with the mustardy undertones of a gai lan. So I love gai lan on, like, that's been barbecued or grilled. And in the book, it's served with a soy sauce tahini. So it's a really basic sauce. Just got tahini, soy sauce, garlic. Works really well.
Oh, that
serve it
great.
With a green. Yeah, really great for a campfire.
Yeah. And you can pre-make that sauce, right?
Yeah.
Put it in a jar, a little Tupperware, bring it with you. You bring the greens and then just, I might just char them on the grill directly over the flame because that's a very quick cook for the greens.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
With the cauliflower, okay, so if you have a grill grate over your campfire, right?
Mm-hmm.
You probably won't want to throw the whole cauliflower right on the fire because that'll just burn before the inside gets cooked at all.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe you would oil it, rub it with spices or salt, and then maybe set it off to the side so it's hot from the fire but not burning from the fire and just kind of let it go for a while.
Exactly. I'm thinking back to when I had a smoker. I would sometimes put a piece of foil over it in the beginning just to kind of enclose the heat around the cauliflower to begin with. And then, you know, and it does need to go for a long time. You know, I think I would smoke them for like a good hour to 2 hours. But obviously a campfire is different. The heat's more aggressive, more aggressive than a smoker. But yeah, you put off to the side, put some foil over the top, concentrate that heat, and then for the last perhaps half an hour, take that foil off and let it get nice and brown and crispy. I love this idea because I think color on vegetables equals flavor. So the deeper you get that color, the more flavor it's going to have. And, you know, just as a general rule, we don't have to be that delicate with vegetables. You know, we can char them. And as long as it's not burnt all the way through, a little bit of charring.
Yeah, but just a little on the edge, a little on the side, like you would want like a pizza crust or with, you know, whatever. Just a little bit of that blackening. Yeah.
Absolutely. And this is how you make vegetarian cooking exciting and delicious. You know, adding texture, you're adding layers of flavor that contrast with one another. Love that.
It's actually, you know, it's funny you bring this up because there is a recipe in the book for Brussels sprouts and green onion oil noodles.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a spin on a traditional Shanghaiese dish. And when they make it there, it's like basically they're kind of frying the green onions in oil.
Yeah.
And often it comes out really dark. They're almost, to your point about the charring, it's almost like you're almost burning the green onions and then use that oil to like dress noodles. Tell us about your take on this with the Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, so my take is, it has Brussels sprouts in there. It has finely shaved Brussels sprouts. And they cook together with the green onions. And they just provide another texture. Like the green onions do become very crispy. But because the Brussels sprouts are a little bit hardier than the green onions, they get crispy, but also still have more of a bite to them. And that's mm-hmm. what I really love about this dish is you've got the crispy onions, but then you've also got this other texture.
A little heartier of a crunch with the Brussels
exactly.
sprouts,
exactly.
Right?
Like just more of a mouthfeel. And I love that. I love having different things going on with every mouthful. And the Brussels sprouts works really well because it has that kind of, again, that kind of mustardy undertone that just adds a different flavor to it that works really well with kind of the oniony flavor.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to our next question.
Hey, it's David in Oakland, California. And I'm wondering what I should be doing with this rutabaga I keep seeing at the farmer's market. I've never cooked rutabaga before. I know it's a winter vegetable. I know how to pronounce it, but I have no idea what to do with it. And I was wondering if y'all could clue me in to any techniques or recipes that work really well with this vegetable. Thanks so much.
Right on. Well, thank you for the question, David. I know how to pronounce it. I just need to cook with it. It is a winter vegetable, and I know obviously we're heading into warmer weather now, so it's not entirely seasonally appropriate. But what do you love to do with rutabaga?
Look, I'm going to say I don't eat a lot of rutabaga.
I'm giving you camping questions.
I know, I'm sure I can come up with an answer to this.
Basically, rutabaga is a turnip.
Exactly.
And I'm sure you love turnips.
I do love turnips. A rutabaga, we call rutabaga Swedes in Australia, which is okay. an equally fantastic name as a rutabaga. I don't think they're as juicy as turnips. That would be its only disadvantage. Yeah. But
they're like a little bit waxier than a standard turnip.
They're starchier, I think. More of a starchy, drier feel. I think with turnips, I kind of think of turnips as the alternative to a potato, not as starchy. You know, in my turnip chapter, I have and I think you could definitely do this with a rutabaga. There is an alternative to a potato tortilla, like a Spanish tortilla, but I've used turnips through there. And I think it might even be more successful with a rutabaga, which is a little drier. The turnips or the rutabaga in this instance is sliced thinly with onions, and then it's actually like it's cooked in olive oil, like a confit almost. And then we take some of the oil out so it's not so oily, and then we put egg in. So it's cooked almost identically to a potato tortilla. The other thing about, you know, a rutabaga is I think it will also stand up to really huge savory flavors. So another recipe in Tender Heart I think you could use a rutabaga for is the miso butter glazed turnips or rutabaga. It's served with black rice, but it's a really savory umami miso butter. And we cook the rutabaga in some of that, and then we use it as it becomes kind of glazed. So delicious.
That sounds super good.
Yeah, super good.
Right on. Okay, we have, I think, maybe one more question.
Hi, my name is Bea, and I'm from New Rochelle in New York. And my question is about broccoli. I just can't seem to get a good-tasting broccoli. If I steam it,
oh, no.
It just tastes kind of bland unless I put a lot of butter and salt on it. And if I try it in the oven, either baking or roasting or broiling, then it comes out either really stringy or sort of underdone. How can I get that perfectly crispy, delicious taste that you get at a restaurant? And I have tried putting on olive oil and salt and balsamic vinegar, but nothing seems to help. I'd appreciate your advice on that. Thanks.
Okay, Hattie, I know exactly what I want to say to Bea, but what do you want to say to her first?
Wow. I'm kind of, if people could see my face, I've got my mouth is wide open.
You're shocked.
I'm shocked.
You're agog.
Bea. Oh, I wish I won a whole session with Bea. great question though. Absolutely. I mean, honestly, the broccoli is like my crowning glory. I think I owe my entire career in what I'm doing now to broccoli, because I had this broccoli salad when I had a salad business in Sydney and people were obsessed with it. And it was just was a char-grilled broccoli salad with chickpeas. It was so simple. It had lemon, capers, chili, mint, and it was finished with like Parmesan shavings.
And you would just grill the broccoli until
charred crispy. And I had a I used to do it on the barbecue. I had outdoor grill. But I often now when I make it, I just make it in a fry pan, perfectly charred. I don't pre-boil. Like I've seen some people that pre-boil vegetables and then char it. And to me, that's going to make it way too soft. I think to make it interesting, you need to have, again, a range of textures. So charring on the outside, still a little bit crisp on the inside. But that's just your basic charred broccoli, and you can use that in so many ways. The other thing I would say is make sure you're salting your broccoli. I like to salt and pepper it before I char it. So then the salt almost becomes like encrusted into the broccoli as it cooks. I also like to, actually in Tenderheart, I like to kind of marinate it almost in a yogurt dressing, like a spiced yogurt dressing. So you take some yogurt, add some spices. It could be whatever spices you have, but turmeric works well, ground coriander, some chili flakes if you have it. And you stir that into the yogurt and then you kind of put your broccoli in there and you kind of smush it all around. And then you can roast it. And then so the...
Oh, cool. Interesting.
The yogurt kind of becomes encrusted on the outside. And you're just adding...
Oh, cool. I've never flavor. Tried that. That's awesome.
You could also do that on the campfire. I'm thinking that could be done on a... just to bring all our questions together.
You don't have to keep building your camping cred.
but that's a really another interesting way. The other recipe... in Tenderheart that I really love, and it's a different way. It's not normally something I would do. I don't usually boil veggies. I'm usually anti-boil veggie person. But there is this one recipe in Tenderheart where I've boiled the broccoli very briefly in salted water. Not quite as salty as seawater, no, but just enough that you can taste it. And what that does is it's almost like a blanch, but it infuses the broccoli with flavor.
But with the salt, yeah.
With the salt, but it also brings out like the sweetness of the broccoli.
Sure.
Because broccoli to me is very sweet. It has this lovely kind of mellow sweetness to it. So it kind of brings out all those flavors and then take it out immediately. And that is probably the only way I'll eat a boiled broccoli, but it's a really nice one to try for a change of pace, because often
I love that a steam or a boil it's kind of nice.
Yeah, it is. It's nice and it's simple and it feels really clean. I like it. It's good. But anyway, I'm going to throw over to you, Francis.
Well, I am so excited about this. I have strong feelings about this because I have now turned on multiple generations of human beings onto the pleasures of roasted broccoli. It is my child's favorite food. She tells me my favorite food is daddy's broccoli. But anyway, I think B's problem, when she says it's stringy, I think it's because she's not peeling the stem. And broccoli is something where, like, I love broccoli, but you do have to peel the stem. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it gets very fibrous. Like and I love the broccoli stem. People, don't throw it away. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly sweet. It's just a super delicious thing. But once you cut the florets off, you got to take a vegetable peeler and just keep going at the stem. And you will see, like, white strings under that first few layers of the stem. Outside of the bark of the stem almost.
Yep.
And then when you get to this more translucent heart, that is just pure gold. It's crisp, it's sweet, it's juicy, it's really, really wonderful.
It's so good.
Yeah, that'll get rid of the stringiness.
Yep.
And often if you're like steaming or boiling, that those fibers will kind of soften, so you don't notice it in that. But if you're roasting, it doesn't cook long enough for those fibers to really kind of dissolve or whatever happens. So you gotta peel it.
Yeah. Agreed.
The other thing I might say, is if you're roasting and you're not getting good color, or you're getting color but it's too hard, I would say turn up the temperature or just cook it longer. I roast my broccoli. I always break in the florets first. Some people like to roast whole broccoli, but I like in florets first because when I cut in the florets about bite-sized pieces, if you're baking it at like 425, 450, 475, sometimes I'll even do, and it's well oiled and well seasoned and all spread out on one sheet tray, then in about 15 minutes, you'll almost always find it's charred and frizzled, like the little tips are starting to get frizzly and crispy, and it's tender enough to eat. So like that's kind of my magic ratio. Anything above 425 in florets, as long as all spread out and well seasoned and oiled, you'll get that beautiful, to me, the sweet spot of charred, frizzled, crispy, but still tender. So I would say try those things, Bea. But for, in terms of ideas, Hedy had all the ideas. So
no, not really. I love your ideas. No, I love because that's, I mean, and that you saying 475, that shows you how hot you can go. That's a hot oven. I mean, that's that's baking sourdough.
That's temperature. I have a screaming 7-year-old and we need to get this done in 10 minutes.
Yeah. Exactly. But that's
Lately, what I've even started to do is just throw it under the broiler, but that's a different conversation because then you got to keep making sure you're not actually setting it on fire.
Exactly. But I think it's a really fine example of how much heat you can use with vegetables to get the texture that you're looking for.
Yeah. I love that. You have a note too in the early part of the book where it's like, you don't have to be gentle with them. They can really take a lot.
Yeah.
But Hedy, it has been wonderful to talk with you. Like I said, I made dinner from your book last night and just do it again tonight.
What did you make, Francis?
I made the miso mushroom ragu with polenta.
Oh, awesome.
Super yummy.
Amazing. Oh, this has been so fun. We could talk for hours about vegetables.
Yeah. I think we just did.
I think we did.
Yeah. Well, I'll see you next time, Hedy. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Eat your vegetables, everyone.
Hedy Louie McKinnon's latest book is Tender Heart, a cookbook about vegetables and unbreakable family bonds. You can find her recipes for that incredible sesame mushroom toast and for her eggplant tossu at splendidtable.org. Coming up, rethinking the world of leftovers. Tamar Adler, author of The Everlasting Meal Cookbook. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1-gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Tamar Adler has long been one of my favorite writers. She is one of the rare food essayists who takes cooking as seriously as she does writing. And I'm sure she's wary of being compared to the likes of MFK Fisher and John Thorne, but I'll just say she has long been compared to the likes of MFK Fisher and John Thorne. Anyway, about 10 years ago, she released a modern classic. It was called An Everlasting Meal. It's a collection of essays
about the rhythms of a life infused with cooking. And now she has a very practical follow-up, the Everlasting Meal Cookbook, which is all about what to do with leftovers. And I mean all of your leftovers. Hey, Tamar, it's great to see you.
Hi, it's so good to see you.
Okay, so when you were writing this book, you have to let me know how this happened, because I'm looking at this thing and I'm thinking, did she really just try to come up with a list of every possible thing you could ever have leftovers of and then figure out something to do with each and every one of them? Like, is that how you wrote this book?
Well, I mean, kind of. Like, that was what I wanted to do. And then I realized I couldn't, I mean, I couldn't really do it because I don't know that many things. And I cannot believe that Chat GPT got released like right after the book came out, because obviously the perfect way to have gotten all of these leftovers ideas, because the whole book is searchable by leftover. And it's like, so I wanted to put every single possible leftover in there. And I wish I could have just asked, you know,
some Chat computer GPT, god.
Computer god, what are all the leftovers? But instead of that, I actually hired an amazing woman named Amanda Kingsley, and I asked her to make 26 spreadsheets, like one for every letter of the alphabet, and then I gave her this huge box of cookbooks that she still has, actually. But like, I tried to give her a cookbook from like Amanda, if you're out there, give them back. But I like put in every, like, I tried to do a sampling from every part of the world. So like, mm-hmm. there was a Palestinian cookbook and a Burmese cookbook and a South Indian cookbook and a, you know, Northern Italian cookbook. And like, it's just that, and then I said, like, literally go through the index and write down everything that is a food that you could have left over and just keep doing that. And then that.
That's incredible. So you had 26 spreadsheets of all these different dishes and ingredients, and it was then your job to think of something delicious to do with every one of them.
Yeah.
And some of them are, like, you know, honestly, super practical and sensible, right? Oh, what do you do with the hearts of lettuce? Or if you have, I love this one, if you have leftover coconut milk, just swap it in for some of the water next time you're making rice, and it's just going to make your rice more delicious. So some of them are very quick, smart tips. But I love that it's also not this whole like, oh, look, my life is always so perfect and graceful. I've always got these beautiful beans. And oh, if you only have a cup of the beans left over, turn it into this gorgeous Northern Italian sauce. No, it's like one of them is for leftover overcooked fish. You know, it's a very real world.
Yes. Yeah. And they're all a lot like that. And I really, that was part of the reason I wanted the book to be like, obviously, it's not every single possible leftover, but I really wanted, you know, eat every little thing that you might have sitting around and that I have sitting around. And like, I do have leftover overcooked fish because, like, you know, the big fat part of the fish was cooked perfectly, but then the end bit got a little bit overcooked. Everybody has that, you know, like there's mm-hmm. this stuff that, like, just like everybody has wilted celery. Like, we all have wilted celery. It's not... it's not an idealized world that this book exists in. It's
not a character
world.
Failing that you have wilted celery or that you overcooked your fish. So actually, since we've teased the overcooked fish, why don't you let us know what we should do with overcooked fish?
Well, what I really like to do is put it in like a little bit of very well-seasoned olive oil, flake it, put it in well-seasoned olive oil, and then use it as a kind of a pasta sauce. That's one really great solution. Another is you can cut it up really small and then cook it with a lot of olive oil and eggs. Another one is, I do a lot of things with overcooked fish, but it does make a really great pasta sauce.
Oh, I love that. Actually, there's like a canned tuna pasta sauce I make sometimes. And that makes sense because canned tuna, we don't think about it.
Is
overcooked fish.
Exactly. Yes. And that's how I tend to use mine, is like make a delicious, oily, tomato-y pasta sauce. And it doesn't, just think of it as canned tuna.
Right on. And you have things to do with leftover salad. Salad is something I never thought you could really have leftovers of because it wigs people out. The salad gets wilty, it gets sort of limp. So people just automatically throw it away. But you have leftover salad ideas.
Yes, I do. And I also think it's really important to like think of leftover salad as salad that's been a little bit cooked by time. You know, it's like and also by vinegar and oil.
Sure.
Like you've been ceviche-ing your salad overnight. I really, really love to thinly slice leftover salad. This is lettuce salad. And then boil eggs, scoop out the yolks, and then smash them with essentially like the ingredients of Caesar salad dressing. So pounded garlic, an anchovy, lemon juice, some Parmesan. Mix that all together and then add thinly sliced salad to that. And then put it back in the eggs. And you end up with these really delicious, it's like Caesar salad inside of an egg. It's like an inverted Caesar salad. And the texture of the lettuce is wonderful in that.
Yeah, because you don't want it as crisp as it was when it was fresh, actually. You like it a little bit with less of its bite.
Yeah, and you want it to be like, yeah, just barely resistant, beautifully seasoned.
Oh, very cool. Well, I want to know about another salad. I know you have a fried rice Frito salad.
Oh, yes. there was that one and a few other ones. My husband was like, I don't think anybody needs this. But I was like, I disagree. I needed it. When I made it, I needed it. And it was, you know how sometimes it's really nice to have something crispy on fried rice, on the official end, it would be like fried garlic, which would be on Atsalag, like a Filipino thing would be fried garlic. And then fried shallot would be like a Thai thing. And Fritos would be an American thing. So it's like, it came from having a little bit of leftover Fritos. And I know that maybe doesn't happen all the time, but sometimes you have like the bottom of a bag, let's say you stopped at a gas station, you were almost home, you got your Fritos or your Doritos. There's also a Dorito salad for this same problem if you chose Doritos. And then but then you got home and you're like, you know what? I don't need to finish these Fritos. You're not going to shove them in my face. I'm going to go inside.
That's where you and I are different, but go on.
Well, I keep on thinking with this book that if I provide a solution to what to do with the last little bit of Fritos, you won't feel like you need to stuff them in your face.
Oh, sure.
Because you'll be like, I can use these on fried rice tomorrow. This is a pretzel thing also, like the bottom crunchy bits in a pretzel bag. I also made a really delicious like seasoning salt with the bottom of a bag of like Nashville hot fried chicken potato chips. And there were like the little crumbly bits at the bottom. And I just smashed those up and added some lime zest. And it was like a delicious little seasoning salt. I love using the very end of salty snacks.
A processed food.
Yeah. Because
the stuff is literally engineered to be delicious.
Yeah. It's cheap and it's cheaply made, but it has a lot of flavor.
Yeah, for sure.
So use all of it.
Use all of it. That should be the last page in the book. Use all of it. Yeah. All right, there's another one too. Like you're big into, well, we actually talked about this. You're big into pancakes. And you have this idea that like, there are all these dishes that people think of, oh, this is like the fridge odds and ends catch-all, right? Like fried rice is one of these sort of vehicles for leftovers. But you have this idea of pancakes being a leftover catch-all.
Yeah, and worth noting, I don't think the idea is mine. I also love the fact that you started this by saying you're big into pancakes, because I feel like that was an awesome sentence. Like, I am big into pancakes. I am. I'm big and I'm into pancakes.
That's a different sentence. But anyway, go on.
No, but like, I think that probably the first savory pancake I probably had was a scallion pancake.
Sure, yeah.
Like a Korean scallion pancake. And then I also remember like literally 20 years ago when I started eating dumplings at, I think it might have been the first outpost of Vanessa's Dumplings on Eldridge Street.
Oh, yeah, in Lower East Side, Chinatown, yeah.
Yeah, there was a really big pancake, I don't know the name of, that was covered with sesame seeds, and you could get it, they would fry it in a big in a big frying pan and then fill it with like meat and all this delicious stuff. And between that pancake and a scallion pancake, and then, the world's many flatbreads, paratas, and, there are so many savory pancakes in the world. I think I kind of took the idea that, it doesn't have to be exactly the same flour mixture, exactly that batter, but I could do a similar thing. And there is obviously a kimchi pancake, that already exists. So springing off of that idea, I've started putting basically anything at all in pancake better or crepe better. And it, like, I've never made a bad pancake. And it could be anything. It's like, sometimes it's like sauerkraut, kimchi, a tiny bit of leftover coleslaw, and, like, you know, whatever, leftover fish, overcooked fish. It, it just doesn't matter. Fish. Yeah. Like, or like, the tops of
the last two slices of ham or whatever.
Totally. Always good. Yeah. And, like, oh my God, leftover fried clams. Like, seriously, delicious pancake.
Okay, so what goes into that pancake base, that batter?
The one that I think I use the most often is a cornstarch batter.
Oh, okay.
That's in the book. It's like a very that's if I'm making it specifically. It depends if I'm dealing with leftover pancake batter or leftover, you know, like kimchi, etc.
Okay,
if
sure.
If I have like a savory leftover, then I'll probably make a cornstarch batter or a sourdough batter. Super, super simple. And then just mix in, because those are both quite savory batters, then mix in the leftover. But then sometimes I have leftover pancake batter because I like made a lot because everybody was like, oh, I'm big into pancakes. But then nobody ate that many pancakes. But then that's fine. I just add some salt to it later, maybe a little bit of fish sauce, and then add the savory stuff to that.
Wait, literally like breakfast pancakes?
Oh, yeah.
That you will then add? Yeah. Salt and savory seasonings too, and then you can add stuff to it.
Yeah, or like a little bit of dashi. If I add a little bit of dashi to breakfast pancake batter, and then like a little bit more flour, it's so delicious. Yeah,
and it thins it out. And so cool! I never thought about that.
And then it's kind of like lacy, crepey.
Oh, I love that.
And then
that.
You can put in leftover overcooked fish, and it's like really really good. And then you can make a little, you know, it takes a little time that you can make a little dipping sauce, like your recipe for scallion ginger sauce is in this book. It's called Francis Lamb's Scallion Ginger Sauce.
Well, I didn't look for it in the index, but now I will.
Because it's my favorite sauce of all time.
Oh my goodness. Well, thank you very much.
It's so good. I almost always have it. And if I don't have it, I have the oil from it, which obviously I then just use as it is or reuse to make more of Francis Lamb's scallion ginger sauce.
Well, thank you. Well, for those listening, if you haven't heard, it's actually an incredibly simple sauce. You mince ginger, you mince scallions, just do it in the food processor, heavily salt it, and then you put it in a bowl and just dump a whole lot of super hot, like you heat oil on the stovetop, and then you dump it all carefully, don't hurt yourself, onto that ginger and scallion mixture, and it sizzles in this bowl. And then when it cools back down, it's just a super delicious sauce, and you've got this beautiful oil that sits on top of it that you can use.
It's so good. And I that's like a beloved savory pancake dipping sauce. So good.
Well, Tamar, you have done a great thing for the world. And I don't mean talk about my sauce. I mean
writing this. By spreading the word of my sauce.
By spreading the word of my sauce. But this is truly just a really useful and super fun reference and just book of inspiration. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Tamar Adler is the author of The Everlasting Meal Cookbook, Leftovers A to Z. And that is our show for the week. Thank you for listening, and go eat something great today. I'll talk to you next week. ABM Studios are run by Chandra Kavani, Joanne Griffith, and Alex Schaffer. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made each week by technical producer Jennifer Lutke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review, especially if you like us. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.